Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and John Russell will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, what, if anything, should the United States be doing in the fight against violent extremism in a part of Africa where few people live? Experts on Africa are asking that question after the deaths of four U.S. Special Forces soldiers in Niger last month. At least four Nigerian soldiers also died in the attack. Before the violence, some members of Congress knew about U.S. operations in Niger. But other lawmakers say they did not know American troops were on the ground in the African nation. They include Senator Lindsey Graham of the Republican Party and Chuck Schumer, the leader of Democrats in the Senate. The U.S. Department of Defense says more than 800 American troops are in Niger. It also confirms the existence of two bases for drone aircraft there. Niger and Burkina Faso want the United States to do more to support African governments in their fight against extremism. They want financial support for a new task force made up of troops from five African countries. It is estimated that about $500 million will be needed for the first year of operations of the force. The United States is considering giving $60 million. The United States military began increasing its presence in the Sahel area in 2007 by creating the U.S. Africa Command, known as AFRICOM. It is based in Stuttgart, Germany. AFRICOM works with African countries to strengthen security on the continent. Since at least 2013, U.S. forces have carried out operations to train, advise, and assist Niger's military. The two sides work with local officials to fight armed extremists. Niger has been an important partner. During the presidency of Barack Obama, the U.S. military built drone bases in the capital, Niamey, and in the northern city of Agadez. Lisa Mueller is an assistant professor of political science at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. She says, because Niger has been a strong ally to the counterterrorism efforts, it has been natural for the United States to station its counterterrorism forces in that country. But the death of the American troops has caused an examination of U.S. partnerships in the Sahel. It is not clear if or how President Donald Trump or his administration will change its policy in the area. Some activists and U.S. lawmakers do not like the fact that some of the African partners have authoritarian governments. Brandon Kindhammer is an associate professor and director of the International Development Studies Program at Ohio University. He says, even the government of Niger is, in his words, problematically democratic. But he says the U.S. involvement is helpful. It's pretty clear that these investments do make a real difference in the ability of the region to provide its own security, he said. Kendhammer says an important part of that success has come from asking partners for their opinion about what should be done and how. He notes that some observers believe the U.S. African Command makes its own decisions without asking the opinions of African leaders. But he says AFRICOM has a history of working with local officials and asking for their advice. U.S. military officials expect to complete their investigation into the Niger attack in January. Kendhammer says it appears that the American soldiers were involved in the kind of work that troops based in the Sahel must do, training local forces in everything from basic operations to advanced tactics, including reacting quickly to terrorist attacks. Kendhammer says the U.S. military wants to have a long-term effect on the area, so it follows the train-the-trainer model. American soldiers train local forces who then share their knowledge and skills with other troops. No one has claimed responsibility for the October attack, but the U.S. military suspects militants linked to the Islamic State group were involved. The group is one of several extremist organizations operating in the Sahel. The extremists are usually local militants who promise to support an international organization like Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. This affiliation might be nothing more than being mentioned in an IS publication or could involve repeated contacts with the larger organization. He notes the group that may have carried out the attack in Niger was at one time allied with Al-Qaeda, but changed in 2015 or 2016 to find a better partner. Local militants use methods designed to weaken American efforts for fighting terrorists. As VOA reported earlier, it is likely that villagers in Tongo Tongo, where the October attack took place, helped trap the American and Nigerian forces. The villagers' apparent willingness to help militants may be the result of their efforts to build trust with local populations while denouncing America.
Ernest Hemingway was a famous American writer. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1954. One of his most famous books, The Sun Also Rises, ends with the following words.
"Yes," I said. "Isn't it pretty to think so?"
Today, we are going to consider the grammar behind the sentence, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" In this program, we will study how English speakers use shortened sentences. We will hear examples of other short sentences from films, books, and fictional conversations. But first, we will start with some definitions.
Clauses are groups of words that have a subject and a predicate. A predicate is a group of words that tells something about the subject. When a clause has a period at the end of it, it is a sentence. For example, in the sentence, "I love English grammar," the word "I" is the subject and "love English grammar" is the predicate. Sometimes sentences have many clauses. These clauses can begin with the word "that" or a word beginning with the letters WH, such as why, what, where, or when. For example, in the sentence, We hope that you enjoy learning English grammar. The words "that you enjoy learning English grammar" are a clause. The clause begins with the word "that." It is an example of a "that" clause. When speaking, Americans often shorten clauses that repeat what they have said earlier. In addition, they often shorten clauses that repeat what someone else has said. These short expressions usually occur after certain verbs. We will now explore these verbs and a few shortened clauses they often go with.
Speakers often shorten WH clauses, usually after they use the verbs wonder, know, or remember. When speakers shorten the WH clauses, they usually only use the WH word itself. They leave out the rest of the clause. Here is an example. Imagine two friends talking about a third person who apparently went missing the night before.
Tom didn't come to the show last night.
I wonder why.
In the example, the second speaker used a shortened clause. Instead of saying, "I wonder why Tom didn't come to the show last night," the speaker said, "I wonder why." This is an example of a shortened WH clause after the verb wonder. The speaker did not want to repeat all of the information discussed earlier. Such lengthy speech would create very long and slow conversations. Now, let's consider a second example. In the 2004 film Crash, actress Sandra Bullock says the following line.
I am angry all the time, and I don't know why. Carol, I don't know why.
Here, Bullock says, "I don't know why," instead of, "I don't know why I am angry all the time." She uses a shortened WH clause after the verb know. The two examples we gave you both had the word why in them. I wonder why, and I don't know why. These are two very common uses of a shortened WH clause. Please remember that English speakers will also use other WH words in shortened clauses. You might hear a person say, "He doesn't remember where," for example.
Now, let's turn to a second group of clauses. They are called that clauses. Speakers often shorten that clauses, usually after they use verbs such as guess, say, think, and hope. The word so often takes the place of the that clause. This sounds difficult, but we will give you examples to clarify the point. Here is one from the 1991 film, The Man in the Moon.
Marie, is it always gonna hurt this bad? Mama says it won't. I hope she's right. I hope so.
Here, the second speaker says, "I hope so," instead of the full sentence, "I hope that she is right." In other words, so takes the place of an entire that clause. Now, let's consider a second example. Remember the lines you heard at the beginning of this report?
"Yes," I said. "Isn't it pretty to think so?"
Just before those lines come in Ernest Hemingway's book, two characters, Jake and Brett, are talking about their unfulfilled love for each other. Brett says that she and Jake could have had such a good time together. Jake responds with the famous line, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" Jake could have said, "Isn't it pretty to think that we could have had such a good time together?" Such a line would have been much less elegant than Hemingway's ending.
The next time you are reading a book in English or talking with an English speaker, try listening for examples of shortened clauses. Does the writer or speaker use one of the shortened clauses we talked about today? What verbs does the speaker use with the shortened clause? Try using examples of shortened clauses that you hear. Or try to use some of the examples we told you about. If you practice using shortened clauses, we think that you will make progress.
No, we know so. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. That Constitution, with other amendments added over the years, is still the law of the land. The delegates agreed to start the convention as soon as seven states were represented. On May 25th, they finally began. They gathered in the same room where America's Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The first important decision was choosing a president for the convention. Several of the delegates urged the others to choose George Washington. Washington was the most famous man in America. He had led the forces that won the war for independence from Britain. The delegates agreed. Washington was their choice. George Washington officially opened the convention with a short speech. He thanked the delegates for naming him president of the convention. But, he said, the honor was too great. He asked the delegates to forgive him if he made mistakes. After all, he said, he had never been chairman of a meeting before. With those words, George Washington sat down. Here are two actors playing George Washington and James Madison. They discuss Washington's role in writing the Constitution.
As for that document, I merely stood back and let the learned gentlemen do their work. I believe I spoke only once in convention, and that to a minor point.
Well, I believe you do yourself an injustice, sir. As president of the convention, you led the way.
Washington did lead the way, but it was not a straight path. From the beginning, the delegates agreed that they had the right to change their decisions. This was the rule. The convention did not just discuss a proposal, vote on it, and move on to other issues. Any delegate could ask to again discuss any proposal or any decision, and they often did. The same speeches that were made the first time were made again. So days, even weeks, passed between discussions of the same proposal. The delegates also agreed on a rule of secrecy. Guards were placed at the doors of the State House. Newspaper reporters were not allowed inside. And the delegates were not allowed to discuss convention business in public. The secrecy rule led people to think all kinds of things about the convention. This was true especially in Europe. There, most people believed the convention was discussing how America could be ruled by a king. Europeans said a republican government worked in a small country, such as Switzerland, but it would not work, they said, in a land as large as America. At the time of the convention, Thomas Jefferson was serving as America's representative to France. When he learned of the secrecy rule, he was angry. He believed strongly in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. More than 40 years later, James Madison explained the decision behind the secrecy rule. Madison said that if the convention had been open to the public, no delegate would ever have changed his mind after speaking on an issue. To do so would mean he was wrong the first time he spoke, and no delegate would be willing to admit to the public that he had made a mistake. This was Madison's reasoning. If the meetings had been open, he said, the convention would have failed. Another rule helped the delegates speak freely. They used a method of debate known as the Committee of the Whole. It was useful then, and it is still used today in legislatures. Votes taken in the committee are not recorded as final votes. The Committee of the Whole provides a way for people to discuss ideas and vote, but also to change their minds. To have the Philadelphia Convention become a Committee of the Whole, the delegates needed to elect a chairman of the committee. They chose Nathaniel Gorham, a judge from Massachusetts. Each morning at 10 o'clock, the convention met and declared that it was sitting as a committee of the whole. George Washington then left the president's chair. Nathaniel Gorham took his place. Just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Committee of the Whole declared it was sitting again as a convention. Gorham would step down, Washington would take the chair, and declare that the convention would meet again the next morning. This process was repeated each day. Because of these rules, the story of the Philadelphia Convention would be difficult to understand if we told about events day by day. So we will put the calendar and the clock away and tell how each major issue was debated and settled. On May 29th, the delegates heard what was called the Virginia Plan. This was the plan of government prepared by James Madison and other delegates from Virginia. The Virginia Plan did more than suggest changes to the Articles of Confederation. It was, in fact, a plan for a completely new central government. Immediately, the 33-year-old governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, proposed an amendment. The Virginia Plan, he noted, spoke of a federal union of states. But such a federation would not work, he said. Instead, Randolph suggested that the central government should be a national government. It should contain a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. For a few moments, there was complete silence. Many of the delegates seemed frozen in their chairs. Did they hear correctly? Most of them did not question the idea of a government with three separate branches. Several states already had such a system. But to create a central government that was national and supreme, what did these words mean exactly? What was the difference? The delegates debated the meaning of the words federal, national, and supreme for many days. Both James Madison and a Pennsylvania delegate, Governor Morris, tried to explain. Madison said, "A federal government acts on states. A national government acts directly on the people." Morris gave this explanation. "A federal government is simply an agreement based on the good faith of those involved. A national government has a complete system of operation and its own powers." Governor Morris pointed out that one day the delegates meeting in Philadelphia would be dead. Their children and grandchildren, he said, would stop thinking of themselves as citizens of Pennsylvania or New York or North Carolina. Instead, they would think of themselves as citizens of the United States. Morris said the states had to take second place to a national government with supreme power. Other delegates presented their own plans for discussion. Alexander Hamilton of New York suggested giving the national government almost unlimited powers. Hamilton's ideas were not popular. After Hamilton's five-hour speech, one delegate said, "Hamilton is praised by everybody. He is supported by no one." New Jersey also offered a plan. An actor playing James Madison at a museum in Washington, D.C. says that plan was not popular either.
And William Paterson unveiled the New Jersey plan, calling for one house of equal representation. I knew that Delaware, Rhode Island, and the other small states would never go along with that.
Delegates voted to reject the New Jersey plan. They did not even vote on Hamilton's plan. From that time, all their discussions were about the plan presented by Virginia. For more than 3 months, delegates would debate each part, vote on it, then debate it again. The Virginia Plan formed the basis of discussion at the convention in Philadelphia. In the end, it formed the basis of the United States Constitution.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.